daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to the panel discussion of World Today. I'm Ding Heng in Beijing. The anti-China element in Washington has found new targets these days. Chinese-made cranes and smart cars. Everything sounds familiar, with allegations that these products pose a national security threat to the United States. Most recently, a few trade unions filed a petition asking the White House to open a trade investigation into China's practices in the shipbuilding and maritime logistics sectors. It is widely believed that the White House is unlikely to turn down that request due to domestic political reasons. In a U.S. election year, are we going to see more turbulence between the U.S. and China over economic and trade issues? This question and much more in this edition of the program. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on our previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. So joining us now on the line are Professor Liu Yue, Dean of the Academy of Global Innovation and Governance with the University of International Business and Economics, and a Senior Fellow with the Center for China and Globalization. Dr. Harry Tark, Emeritus Professor of Political Science and International Relations with Purdue University, as well as Dr. Li Peimei, Assistant Professor of Political Science with the International Islamic University, Malaysia. So, Dr. Liu Yue, let me start with you. Judging from the Xi Jinping-Joe Biden summit in November last year, it looks the Biden administration wants to stabilize the relationship with China. So, with that in mind, why do you think on some specific economic or trade issues, Washington has continued to take some sort of hostile actions against China, which will certainly create more tensions with China?
Okay, thank you for your question. Actually, the position and the strategy of the U.S. toward China have been finalized, which is marked by the national security strategy of the Biden administration and the new Washington consent. From the Biden administration's national security strategy already states that in the competition with the PRC, it's clear that the next 10 years will be the decisive decade. Also, the last year, April of last year, the U.S. National Security Advisor John Sullivan also delivered a speech entitled Renewing American Economic Leadership at the Brookings Institution, in which Sullivan officially declined the depth of the Washington consent and proposed a set of policy propositions of new Washington consent. So in this context, it's difficult for the Biden administration to change the established arrangement and the policy path of the suspension channel. Especially in an election year, the Biden administration may roll out more policy alike for the election.
Okay. So, Dr. Li Peimei, going to you, let's actually take a look at some of the most recent examples of products or industries over which the U.S. has hit out at China or will likely target China in the foreseeable future. Chinese-made cranes, Chinese-made smart cars or EVs, and China's shipbuilding industry. Do you think the U.S. concerns in these specific areas are legitimate? And do you think these concerns have anything in common?
Thanks, Ding Heng, for the question. Yes, of course, I think as what Professor Louis said, the U.S. always use national security concerns when there are making any sanctions against China or prop against China. So in this case, although we see that the U.S. cited national security concerns over Chinese cranes and other items, actually there is no concrete evidence to prove that they do pose a threat to the U.S. national security. Therefore, I think it's understandable why Chinese firms feel they have been treated very unfairly by the United States. So from my perspective, why do the United States have concern in this area. The main reason, I believe, is because these are the areas where China is actually leading far ahead of the United States. And take, for example, we look at shipbuilding industry. The U.S. was once a leader in the commercial shipbuilding industry. But as others actually catch up, U.S. firms become less competitive. And in terms of the Chinese made smart cars, the U.S. said that these smart cars would gather massive amounts of information about American citizens. So they have concerns about privacy and how the Chinese firms is going to use this data, which might threaten their national security. However, if you look at what's happening on the ground, the U.S. has actually been imposing high taxes on Chinese cars, which means that in actual reality, there are very few Chinese cars that have entered the U.S. market. And given this situation, even for the Chinese EVs, they actually have not really entered the U.S. market. So how should we say that the Chinese EVs are actually collecting massive amounts of information about the drivers when, you know, in actual reality, they have not really entered the U.S. market? But as a matter of fact, there was a research conducted by the Mozilla Foundation, which actually found that there are car brands such as Nissan and Kia, which collect intimate information about drivers. So let's look at Kia privacy policy. They stated that they could collect a wide range of data, which includes race, religion, and even political opinions. So these are the data that we understand are not required for the operation of the vehicles. And therefore, the U.S. should be really concerning about these car brands because there is clear evidence showing that they collect excessive data about a citizen. Then the question is, why, if the U.S. is really concerned about their national security, why are not they not taking actions on these car brands, but instead they are suspecting that Chinese EVs, which has not really entered the U.S. market, would collect a lot of information about its citizen and pose a threat? So clearly here we can see that the Biden administration is discriminating against Chinese firms.
Okay, so thank you very much for this very detailed and unique observation on your part. Now, Professor Targ, in the case of both Crane and Smart Car, China's official response to the U.S. investigation is that China opposes overstretching the concept of national security. So, do you think there is really an overstretching of the national security ground here?
I would like, if it's okay with you, to make some general observations about United States policy towards China and that impacts on trade and political decisions as well. My sense of the long history of U.S. foreign policy is that it's driven by a desire to create and maintain global hegemony. And in this sense, China is perceived in Washington as a significant threat to that maintenance of global hegemony. I was very much taken by a recent book by a U.S. historian named Alfred McCoy, who in his book called In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, he makes the case that, relatively speaking, U.S. economy is on the verge of falling behind the Chinese economy, and that the United States, because of this tradition of trying to maintain global hegemony, has increased its commitment to military superiority. And we see that in dramatic increases in military expenditures in the United States, the supplemental military authorization, which is still being talked about in Congress, calls for significant additional funding for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. And I think this supplemental reflects the international concerns of United States foreign policy today. And I'm reminded of the metaphor that former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright used: the United States is the indispensable nation. So that in general, rather than the United States adopting a view that we are increasingly living in a multipolar world and should engage in more multilateral action, the U.S., it seems to me, is committed to a policy of ratcheting up competition and hostility towards China. I have some interesting quotes I could read to you later on that reflect U.S. national documents vis-a-vis China and U.S. national security. But this drive for the maintenance of global hegemony is fraught with contradictions, and among them are the significant trade relations between the United States and China, the importance of the U.S. Importing major commodities like the iPhone, for example, and the increasing network of economic ties between U.S. capital and Chinese economic leaders as well. So that the policy is in some ways contradictory, and there are challenges to the drive for hegemony. But I guess I would argue that U.S. policy, from my point of view, unfortunately, is still driven by this idea that the United States could and should be the number one power in the world.
Yeah, thank you very much for providing us with this overarching bigger picture. That's very important regarding the understanding of some of the more detailed or specific issues. Now, Professor Liu Yue, going back to you, apart from those very recent examples I talked about earlier, probably a more high-profile case is the semiconductor industry. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo said earlier this month that the U.S. is constantly, almost on a daily basis, evaluating whether to broaden its chip export controls against China with an aim of making sure that China cannot access sophisticated American technology. Now, the stated concern on the U.S. side is about China's military, but do you think that's the actual main reason why the United States is restricting China's access to advanced American chips?
I think the United States restricts China's access to advanced American chips for a variety of reasons. Firstly, it's about the technological leadership, because maintaining leadership in key technology areas is part of the American's long-term strategy. By restricting the export of advanced technology to China, the U.S. tried to slow down China's rapid technology development and innovation capabilities in order to maintain its advantage in the global technology competition. For example, as the CHIPS and Science Act in 2020 depicts, it will help U.S. Regain its leadership in semiconductor manufacturing. The second reason, I think, is about the economic benefits. The semiconductor industry is a vital part of the global economy, and the U.S. want to protect its company from being overtaken in market and technology by foreign competitors, especially like China. This is not just about economic gains, but I think it's also about the distribution of global economic power. The last reason, I think, is also related to geographical competition. The geographical competition between China and the U.S. has intensified, and the semiconductors have become one of the focuses of competition between China and the U.S. By restricting the export of chip technology, the U.S. may try to strengthen its position in the global strategic landscape while weakening China's development. For example, in order to maintain its high technology monopoly advantage, the U.S. has promulgated the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act in 2021, and also the previous I already mentioned about the CHIPS and the Science Act 2022, they all try to consistently suppressing the innovation development of China's chip and other cutting-edge technology fields.
Okay, so I guess for sure the U.S. Tech war, which would include this restrictions against China's access to advanced American semiconductor products. In a big picture sense, I guess this U.S. launched tech war against China has really prompted China to place a greater emphasis in terms of science and tech self-dependence. China is currently believed to be 10 to 15 years behind the U.S. in terms of advanced chip design. Some industry experts in the semiconductor sector says China's emphasis on self-dependence and the corresponding plant investments will reduce that gap down to somewhere between 5 and 8 years. And in the meantime, one thing undeniable is that the United States, by doing so, is actually in a process of losing a key export market for American chips, which I guess is very important for the growth of those U.S. chip makers. So, Dr. Li Peimei, would you agree in this point by some analysis suggesting that a policy of restricting China's access to American technology will, in the end, backfire more than hurting China?
Well, I believe so. Okay, basically, the reason why I think the U.S. is actually restricting advanced chips, mainly because if you look at one analysis by the Allen Institute for AI, it actually showed that China had already surpassed the U.S. in published papers on AI. So meaning that in terms of publication in AI, China is leading. And we understand that, you know, chips, microchips are very important for the development of AI. So in this sense, one of the reasons I think why the United States are restricting China access is try to prevent China to emerge as the global leader in AI. And because there is a saying, whoever leads AI will rule the world. So this is why the US simply cannot sit back and allow that to happen. And as a result of that, we can see that China is actually much more reliant, and they have to, because there's no alternative. And China understands that with given the current geopolitical landscape, the U.S. will continue to restrict its access to chips. So what happened was the U.S. approach has actually somehow unified the people and the companies within China to work harder to achieve breakthrough in technology. The government are also currently redirecting all the resources to the semiconductor industry so that they can ensure its success. So far, we can see that Chinese firms has made some good progress. For example, Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corp, SMIC, they made 7-nanometer chips for Huawei Mate 60 Pro smartphone. And when China announced that, it has successfully produced 7-nanometer chips. Despite the restriction by the United States, it caught many by surprise, because these chips actually represent a cutting-edge technology, right, in the semiconductor industry. And previously, only a very few companies, like in Taiwan, United States, they can master the production of such advanced chips. So we can clearly see that Chinese achievement in developing these chips indicates a significant advancement in its semiconductor capabilities and has drawn attention globally. So, in other words, I believe that, you know, this kind of harsher approach by the United States have actually made China speed up its speed of closing the technological gap with the United States.
Yeah, so I guess that's a very important aspect for our listeners to think about this question. Now, Professor Targ, de-risk is a terminology employed by some American officials nowadays when they talk about the economic ties with China. Chinese officials, on the other hand, say the best way to de-risk is to actually stabilize those normal economic ties or normal economic cooperation between the two sides. So the underlying message here on the Chinese side seems to be, okay, China is not a risk. Instead, a real, genuine risk appears to be a perceived abuse of national security ground or sometimes human rights ground as well by U.S. authorities when they decide to intervene in those normal China-related business operations. What is your take regarding this logic?
Before I do that, I want to refer to in 2022, the Biden administration issued a national security document, which presidents are obliged to do periodically. And there was an interesting article about the 2022 document written by New York Times correspondent David Sanger. And in it, he says, the document describes a more aggressive U.S. effort to enhance cybersecurity and urges work with allies in the private sector to withstand attempts to degrade our shared technology advances by limiting Chinese and other investment in the U.S. and controlling exports of key technologies to China. So I think this document reflects what has been said already about the United States regarding China as a threat, as a challenge, and from my point of view, as a challenge to the tradition of U.S. global hegemony. And the alternative, I think what you're suggesting about no risk, is to increase the necessary collaboration to reduce violence, to address the environmental challenges that the world faces, to address the ongoing current conflicts in Israel and Gaza in Ukraine, that cooperation between the United States and China would be vital. And it's disadvantageous for the United States, China, and the world to regard each other as competitors. So in that sense, I think we scholars and activists have to think about collaboration and reconceptualizing world affairs from that of great power competition to multipolarity and multilateral interaction.
So, Professor Targ, based on what you have elaborated, if you are to put your finger on the single biggest hurdle for U.S.-China cooperation nowadays, what would it be?
There's not one. I would say economics, ideology, and politics. Economics involves the drive for U.S. capitalism to try and achieve hegemony. In terms of ideology, there's the idea of American exceptionalism and the United States as the indispensable nation, which has shaped the consciousness of U.S. decision makers for at least 100 years. And in terms of politics, we alluded to the elections before. To some degree, although it's not the primary motivating issue in the election, but politicians in the United States want to show that they're tough, and they're tough with potential enemies. And many of us in the U.S. are talking about, fearfully, about the emergence of a new Cold War. And those who are articulating new Cold War thinking and identifying China and Russia as the major enemies are using those in the political arena as well. Mm-hmm. And so politicians who act in more diplomatic ways are criticized in our electoral political arena. So economics, ideology, and politics together, I think, are affecting the character of U.S. foreign policy. And from my point of view, this makes for this to be a very dangerous time in world history.
You are listening to World Today. Let's take a short break. Coming back, our discussion will continue. Stay tuned.
I am Dan Wang, Chief Economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
You are listening to World Today. I'm Ding Heng in Beijing. Today we are talking about the China-U.S. economic relations in a U.S. election year. Joining our panel, Professor Liu Yue, Dean of the Academy of Global Innovation and Governance with the University of International Business and Economics, and a Senior Fellow with the Center for China and Globalization, Harry Chark, Emeritus Professor of Political Science and International Relations with Purdue University, and Dr. Li Peimei, Assistant Professor of Political Science with the International Islamic University, Malaysia. Professor Liu Yue, going back to you, so in your observation, to what extent do you think the China-related trade or economic issues will likely be a political issue during the 2024 U.S. presidential election?
I think so far it's okay because now here is still the preliminary stage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, but we still need to stay alert. Because take history as a guide, the issue of U.S. and China economic and trade relation has been brought to the forefront in the previous president election. For example, in August 2020, Trump delivered his nomination speech at the Republican National Convention, mentioning the China 15 times and promoting that China virus. Also, when you think about the 2024 election, the Associated Press statistics showed that the Biden and the Trump have locked the nomination of their representative party president candidates. And attacking China is an important way to build Trump's voter base. So the U.S. and China economic and trade relationship is still likely to be a major political issue. Besides, there are some China-related wars around the current U.S. president election. So there is still a high risk that the candidates will try to use China-related issues to transfer internal and external conflicts, advocate like the de-risking and the generalized China-related issue so as to gain more votes.
So, Professor Tark, some people say the Democrats favor the so-called de-risking while the Republicans are in the camp of decoupling, which could enable them to attack the current White House administration's China policy for being too soft. Is this how you would see it?
You know, I knew you would ask about the elections. Most polling data over the years indicates that American people on the whole are not motivated to vote on foreign policy issues. And with some exceptions, which I'd like to mention, I think that's true today. There exists a kind of what one scholar called the politics of resentment, that is a sense of powerlessness, economic marginalization that lends people to or stimulates people to support candidate Trump. Secondly, race is an issue that has been used in American political discourse to gain support. One international issue which I think is significant is the immigration issue, which has been used and misused by both parties. What among the exceptions to the domestic issues as the primary motivators for voting behavior I would say the current war between Israel and Gaza, and a little less so the war in Ukraine, and at least significant minorities of voters are indicating that they were withdrawing their support from President Biden because of his strong support for Israel, and a little less so critics of U.S. support of Ukraine and NATO. So these issues might have some modest effect on voting behavior. And we know that the votes in five critical states in the United States are very close. And so that if 10,000 or 20,000 voters stay home or do not vote for President Biden, who they ordinarily would vote for, it might tilt the election in favor of candidate Trump. So foreign policy is an issue of less importance often, but in this case, Israel and Ukraine are important. And I think both candidates try to portray themselves as being tough on China as well. So I don't see that much of a difference between Biden and Trump on support of China.
Yeah, I guess that's the consensus on the part of many other political analysts as well. With regard to a 60% or even higher tariff against the Chinese-made products that somebody or some people have talked about during the current election season, Dr. Li Peimei, how would you evaluate the possible impacts of such a hypothetical tariff on the U.S. economy, especially American households and consumers? And I think some people have said that such a tariff would trigger a de facto decoupling between China and the United States. What is your take?
Well, I personally believe decoupling is not feasible. And that's the reason why the Biden administration is now pursuing de-risking instead. Because China plays an important role in the global supply chain today. And I believe China will continue to be to play an important role in the global supply chain of tomorrow. So in terms of slapping higher tariffs on Chinese goods, I agree that it will only cost American consumers more. Well, Trump hopes that by slapping higher tariffs on Chinese goods would give local companies an edge. But the reality is that American consumers will suffer as a result. This is because there are many consumer product goods that American companies do not produce. And that is the reality. So they can only purchase goods manufactured by China, which has become expensive because of the tariffs. And if the goods affected by the tariff are inputs or components used in the production of other goods, so it means that there will be increase in costs in other goods as well. So if the tariff become too expensive for the U.S. companies to import certain goods from China, there's a likelihood that American importers might then have to reduce the range of products that they can offer to the American consumers. So consumers may find fewer options available to them, or they might have to settle for alternatives that probably do not meet their expectations.
Okay. So, Professor Liu Yue, your take?
Based on all my previous research work, we found that if U.S. take the higher tariff on China's products, it will negative effect to the U.S. Domestic customer and enterprise. Because, you know, now we are in the world, it's called the global value chain. So that means every country already be part of the global value chain. So we rely to each other. So even though U.S. Put the tariff to China's products, actually, U.S. Companies still need to import the intermediate products from China. So that means if U.S. put the tariff on China's products, U.S. domestic company will take the cost because they still rely on China's intermediate products. And besides, directly effect, they are also with the indirectly effect, because if the U.S. company do not use China's products, because with the economic perspective, we know that every company trades to the profit maximization. But if they are not using China's good quality and the low price intermediate products, they have to transfer to other intermediate products from some other country like Vietnam or Mexico. But their products will not be perfect to match their company's need. So it will also sacrifice the productivity and the efficiency.
Okay, your point's well taken. So, Professor Targ, in many ways, I think the trade war launched by Washington back in 2018 has really continued in most recent years. One example is that those punitive tariffs during those years have largely remained in place nowadays. Actually, as a matter of fact, a study conducted by this U.S.-China Business Council back in 2021 showed that trade war with China in 2018 and 2019 had cost the American economy nearly a quarter million jobs. So, under a purely economic sense or economic logic, I guess the U.S. should have undone most of what were widely seen as its previous policy errors back in 2018, 2019, etc. What do you think this very fact that has not really happened tells us?
Well, I'm sorry to return to what I started with. I think American foreign policy has been driven, as I said earlier, by the desire to maintain or enhance its global hegemony. And I wanted to add another element, not in contradiction to what we've been talking about, but those of us who have taught international relations for years used to emphasize great power politics in the days of the Cold War, the conflict between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union. Now some talk about a new Cold War with China. But in fact, I think we're entering a transitional period in international relations in which the traditional great power model of international relations should be replaced by a growing contestation between the global North and the global South. And there are several manifestations of it. The formation of the BRICS in Latin America, CELAC, the non-aligned movement, Organization of Resistance in the Sahel, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and to a considerable degree, the countries and peoples of the global South are rising up, if you will, against the tradition of European and North American colonialism, and look to China as a partner in challenging the traditional unipolar or bipolar shape of the world. And the Chinese, as you know, have launched the Belt and Road Initiative, Chinese trade with the African continent and the Western Hemisphere has increased significantly. There's a rising renewed demand for countries in the global South for new international economic order. So there are lots of things going on in world affairs of which the U.S.-Chinese relationship is just a part. And again, I believe that the U.S. policy of pursuing hegemony rather than multipolarity and de-risk is a big mistake. But it's embedded in our economic institutions, in our military-industrial complex, in our ideology of American exceptionalism. And so these are I don't know if mistakes is even the correct way to put it, that these forces are driving U.S. foreign policy, and they're increasingly challenged by a world in transition, of which China is a significant player.
Okay. So, Professor Liu Yue, this is something you suggested earlier, against the backdrop of these continued U.S. tariffs against the Chinese goods, some businesses have moved at least a part of their production lines from China to a few nations in Southeast Asia or Mexico, for that matter, in order to circumvent the U.S. tariffs. On the other hand, they still need to source a lot of those upstream products or components from China before making them into finished products in these countries I mentioned. So, with that in mind, how do you assess the likelihood that even such a business practice might be targeted by U.S. tariffs as well in the foreseeable future?
I think it's not a realistic way to do the like U.S. to put the tariff to China, as I discussed before. The degree of the global industrial chain collaboration has increased, making it difficult to detach China from the global industrial chain. Because we all know China China already with the world's largest, most diverse and the most comprehensive manufacturing system, occupying a critical position in the global supply chain. As our previous research work, we also found that China is already became the center of the Asian value chain network. U.S. is the center of the North American, and Germany is the center of the EU. So that means in the area of globalization, national interests are deeply intertwined. Attempting to artificially serve global industrial and supply chain is neither realistic nor wise. This is well violate the principle of economics. And second, I also think about the U.S. Way to do is not consistent with the international law and the trade rules. The action taken by the U.S. in expanding the scope of tariffs may be constrained by the rules of the WTO, especially if these actions are perceived as violating the principle of non-discrimination. This would affect the feasibility of the U.S. taking these measures.
Okay. So, Dr. Li Peimei, so let's imagine, well, in the future, any U.S. government wants to levy taxes, punitive taxes, against any products that is assembled in Malaysia or Indonesia or Vietnam or Mexico, but contains a lot of components from China. How realistic would a hypothetical U.S. tariff like that be in terms of its implementation?
Well, clearly, I think there is a high possibility. I mean, they might consider it, but in terms of implementation, it can be complicated. But of course, if Trump is elected, we know that the U.S. might adopt a more aggressive trade policy. But given the complexities of global supply chain and the difficulty of accurately tracking the origin of products, I think imposing tariffs on goods produced by Southeast Asia using Chinese components will be very challenging, because the origin of the products is actually very difficult to accurately track it. So most importantly, I think the U.S. also needs to consider the potential diplomatic and economic consequences of such actions before they can implement the tariffs. So, for example, if they are going to implement a tariff for products made in Malaysia, but using a lot of components from China, then I believe Malaysia government would not be happy with it, because Malaysia government would be in the view that the U.S. is trying to drag Malaysia into this power rivalry competition between the U.S. and China. And therefore, Malaysia would insist that we want to maintain neutrality. And what's more, we hope that the US would not get Southeast Asian countries involved when competing with China. So the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Anwar Ibrahim, he has reiterated on numerous occasions that we are an independent country, yeah, and we do not want to be dictated by any force. So I believe if in the future the US would want to consider implementing such tariff, it would invite backlash from Southeast Asian countries.
Okay. Yeah, I think the recent comment by Malaysia's Prime Minister has been widely reported in the international media arena. So moving production lines out of China due to punitive U.S. tariffs is one aspect. On the other hand, though, some people say businesses also need to acknowledge a very reality that in some categories of products or industries, many so-called replacement countries in Asia, elsewhere in Asia or Mexico, simply don't have the capacity or the capabilities of China. Dr. Li Peimei, would you agree in this point?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, the other countries might have advantage in terms of its low labor costs. But apart from that, I think China still maintains some of its productivity and competitiveness. So, but although there has been reported that there are reallocation of some companies to other countries, some companies from China to other countries, such as to Indonesia. But if you look at the manufacturing capabilities of Indonesia, they are still not as efficient and productive as China. So what we can expect is that the relocation will only involve certain types of firms, which is those that typically produce labor-intensive products. But for China, because they have a very well-established and highly integrated supply chain ecosystem for manufacturing, therefore, it's actually much difficult for companies to actually relocate out of China. Particularly those companies that require a large talent pool and also a highly integrated supply chain. So despite rising wages in China, the overall cost of manufacturing, when considering the supply chain, the efficiency and infrastructure, China would remain competitive. While other countries like Indonesia may offer lower labor costs, they might not be able to match China in terms of its comprehensive cost efficiency when all factors are considered. And not only that, I think the Chinese government also welcome investment. Therefore, they always provide incentives to foreign companies to manufacture in China. And that could include tax breaks and other support measures that can make the business environment actually more attractive. Therefore, if you ask me, I think probably only the labor-intensive manufacturing can relocate to Southeast Asian countries and Mexico. But firms that actually require skilled labor and also high productivity, they would maintain in China.
So talking about foreign investment in China or U.S. investment in China, for that matter, recently, actually, the chief executive of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce led a delegation of former U.S. government officials to China, and she has met with Chinese Premier Li Qiang in Beijing. And according to a survey released by AmCham China in early February, half its members consider China as one of their top three global investment destinations, and some 77% said they had no plan to move their production lines or supply chains away from China. Professor Liu Yue, what do you read from these numbers or figures?
Okay, sure. Despite the trade frictions between China and the U.S., the Chinese market still holds strong appeal for international investors, especially for the American company. Because with the big market and the cost effectiveness and the technology advancement in certain areas provide a foreigner investor with attractive business opportunity. The fact that half of the members already consider China as one of their top three investor destination indicates that many American companies still prefer to fund a strategy to address challenges rather than completely withdrawn from the China market. And besides, 77% of the members indicate that they had no plan to move production and supply chain out of China, revealing China's core position in the global supply chain and the importance of its manufacturing sector. This commitment shows that even in an environment of the increasing protectionism and uncertainty, the structure of globalized the production and the supply chain remains solid. For many business, China is irreplaceable. So we can see that all this data shows that despite political and economic uncertainty, China remains a key commercial and investment hub in the global business environment. And the long-term investment and the market engagement of American business in China have brought them significant business benefits.
So, Professor Tark, last year, actually, Beijing and Washington established two separate working groups, bilateral working groups, one for financial issues and the other for economic and trade issues. To what extent do you think this particular dialogue mechanism could help stabilize the U.S.-China economic relations during the 2024 U.S. presidential election season?
I think these kinds of interactions are potentially very constructive for reducing economic and political tensions between the United States and China, and I celebrate them. I do not believe that they will have any impact on the election at all. I would hasten to add that while I sort of presented this view of the United States, you know, seeking to maintain or enhance its hegemony, what we've been talking about is a contradictory reality, that there are significant U.S. economic interests in investing and trading with China. And so you have these contradictory tendencies at work, and how they play out will affect, you know, the bigger questions of war and peace and economic and political cooperation. But I don't see these interactions as necessarily affecting the election of 2024. I think there are other issues that are dominating the agenda and the discussion during the campaign season.
Well, we have been speaking with Harry Tark, Emeritus Professor of Political Science and International Relations with Purdue University, Professor Liu Yue, Dean of the Academy of Global Innovation and Governance with the University of International Business and Economics, and a Senior Fellow of the Center for China and Globalization, Dr. Li Peimei, Assistant Professor of Political Science with the International Islamic University, Malaysia. That's all the time for this edition of World Today. I'm Ding Hun in Beijing. Thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.